Chapter 19. Doctors of Death. The 9-year-old girl was sobbing so violently that her father could not understand a word she said. He shook her impatiently. "Where is Juliet?" The girl controlled herself for a moment. "She's asleep, and the doctor says he's going to die." The father, Jules Deitch, rushed through the streets to the house where Dr. Etienne Deschamps was lodging. The door of his room was locked. Deitch ran to the police station and begged the police to help him break in. "I think my 12-year-old daughter is in there." She was. When the police entered the room, Juliet was lying naked on the bed. Beside her, also naked, lay a great hairy man with a beard. Blood was streaming from wounds in his chest, but he was still alive. The little girl was dead. It was the beginning of one of the most sensational murder trials in the history of New Orleans. For when the body of Juliet Deitch was examined, it was discovered that she was no longer a virgin, and that she had been carnally abused in other ways. There were even love bites on her body, and, as the evidence made clear, this had not happened just once, but dozens of times over the course of 6 months or so. Dr. Deschamps was obviously the worst kind of pervert. How had the respectable carpenter, Jules Deitch, come to allow his daughter to fall into the hands of a monster? Deitch had met Dr. Deschamps in 1888, when Deschamps had told him that he was adept in the occult. He possessed hypnotic powers, and he intended to use them to discover the lost treasure of the pirate Jean Lafitte. All he needed, he said, was the help of a pure young girl to act as a medium. Deitch was so impressed by the 50-year-old doctor that he had no hesitation in entrusting Juliet to his care. In fact, both his daughters, for Juliet's young sister, Laurence, was fascinated by the doctor and didn't want to be left out. Later, Laurence described the experiments. Juliet would be told to undress and to climb into bed. She was an unusually well-developed child for her age, although she had not yet reached puberty. The doctor would also undress and climb in beside her. He would soak a clean handkerchief in chloroform and place it over her face. The doctor always made them promise not to tell their father what had happened. So things had continued until that afternoon of January the 30th, 1889, when Deschamps had suddenly begun to sob in French, "My God, what have I done?" Then Laurence, who was terrified, was told to run home and tell her father that the doctor was going to die. But the doctor did not die. The stab wounds he inflicted on his chest were too superficial to endanger his life. It was obvious to everybody that Juliet's death was accidental, to everybody at least but the prosecutor. He alleged that Deschamps had deliberately killed the girl because he knew that his sexual abuses would soon be discovered. This was obviously absurd, since killing her was the sure way to discovery. On the other hand, Deschamps was more cunning and calculating than he tried to make out. The police found letters in his room, written by Juliet, and signed "Your Love Forever" and "Your Little Mistress." Juliet, however, was a backward child and could not have compromised them. Deschamps had written them and got her to copy them out so that he could claim she had been willing to be seduced. But if she was willing, why chloroform her, as he had on every occasion? Besides, the letters also mentioned a jeweller in the neighbourhood called Charlie, and implied that he had been the man who had originally taken Juliet's virginity. But Charlie was proved to be innocent. Again, Deschamps was covering his tracks. Why should he, argued the prosecutor, unless he meant to kill her? The Deschamps case, which ended with the doctor being hanged, gained nationwide coverage in the American press. This was not simply because of the sensational nature of the crime, it was because Deschamps was a doctor. It is a curious fact of criminal history that doctors who commit murder excite more interest than almost any other type of criminal. The usual explanation for this is that doctors are supposed to save life, not take it. But that supposes that the public are more interested in morality than they actually are. The true explanation is that the doctor is a symbol of middle-class respectability. In earlier centuries, people felt the same morbid interest in priests who committed crimes. Hence the excitement aroused by the trial of Father Urbain Gardier, burned alive in 1634 on a charge of having seduced and bewitched a convent full of nuns. The great age of medicine was the 19th century. It was also the great age of the medical murderer. Yet the company of killers had one distinguished predecessor of the 18th century, Dr. Levi Weil, whose strange story helps to explain why the medical murderer was such a latecomer on the criminal scene. Dr. Weil, a Dutch Jew, came to London from Holland in the 1760s, the London of Dr. Johnson, of the actor David Garrick and the statesman Edmund Burke. London then was full of disease, and most doctors were constantly busy. But this Jewish doctor, with a foreign accent, encountered a certain amount of prejudice, and his practice remained small. One day, a merchant asked Vial if he would travel out to Enfield, outside London, to attend his sister. The regular doctor was ill. Vial drove to the village, attended the old lady, with some success, and then ate supper with her brother, who paid him in cash. All the way home, Vial thought about the house full of money and jewellery, and determined to take some of it for himself. In the city, he said goodbye to the merchant, and promptly made his way back to Enfield. When he finally reached home by daylight, he was exhausted, but some £90 richer, more money than he had made in months. Ironically, Vial's practice began to improve as his income from burglaries soared to £500 a month. He kept his surgery open, knowing it was his best disguise. He entered the houses of wealthy patients, cased the joint, and passed on the information to a gang run by his brother. On one occasion, he heard that an old caretaker who lived near St. Paul's Cathedral had his life savings hidden in the room. Other burglars had already broken in, but although they had prized up every floorboard and ripped plaster off the walls, they had been unable to locate the money. Vial was called to the old man's bedside when he was ill. He tried to persuade the caretaker to go into hospital. The vehemence with which the idea was rejected convinced Vial that the money was hidden in the room. The floors and the walls had been explored, so it had to be the ceiling. A great beam crossed the room. Vial examined it when the caretaker was asleep and found a cavity. Two nights later, as the old man slept heavily from one of the doctor's sedatives, Asher Vial and an accomplice took nearly £3,000 from the hiding place in the beam. The old man never discovered the robbery. He died a few days later. This may have been Vial's first murder. By then, the gang had swelled to 8. One of the members, a German Jew named Isaacs, tried to conceal more than his share of the booty and was dismissed. That was Vial's first mistake. Not long after, he made his second. In the autumn of 1771, the gang, including Vial himself, waited until after dark in the vicinity of a house in Chelsea Fields. In those days, Chelsea was a village outside London. When all the lights were out, they knocked loudly. The servant who opened the door was overpowered. The lady of the house, a Mrs. Hutchings, fought strenuously, but was tied with her petticoats over her head. In the upper part of the house, the gang burst into a bedroom, and two servants who had been asleep started up, alarmed. One was knocked out. The other, as he struggled, was shot with a pistol. After that, the gang flew with their loot. Unfortunately for them, though, the servant, John Slow, died. Now the authorities decided to offer a reward for the gang, and Isaacs, the man who had been dismissed, saw his opportunity for revenge. He knew that if he turned King's evidence, he would be safe. Vial was planning his most ambitious robbery so far. Of a diamond merchant expecting a consignment of £40,000 worth of jewels, when he was placed under arrest by the Bow Street runners. 6 of the gang were tried. 2 were acquitted for lack of evidence, a proof that even in those days justice was impartial, but Vial and his brother were among those executed at Tyburn on December the 9th, 1771. The next noble name in the roll of medical infamy is that of Dr. Edme Castin of Paris. At the age of 27, Dr. Castin enjoyed the good life and did not look forward to the lifetime of drudgery of a general practitioner. One of his patients was a wealthy man named Hippolyte Ballet, who had tuberculosis. Castin became friendly with Hippolyte's younger brother, Auguste, and learned that the brothers were on bad terms, so bad that Hippolyte had excluded his brother from his will. One evening, as they drank together, Auguste hinted that Castin might hasten his brother's death and gain possession of the will. So, on October the 22nd, 1822, Hippolyte quite suddenly died, to the astonishment of other doctors who had occasionally attended him. A month later, Castin paid off all his debts and lent his mother 300,000 francs. The following year, on June the 2nd, Castin and Auguste Ballet went for a drive in the country and stopped at a hotel in Saint-Cloud, where they ate and drank. Then Auguste was suddenly taken ill and soon died, attended by his friend Castaing and by two other doctors. The other GPs recognised the signs of morphine poisoning, and they discovered that, even after Ballet had started to vomit, Castaing had gone to the local chemist and bought more morphine. When it was discovered that Ballet had made a will in Castaing's favour, the doctor was arrested. Castaing was relying on the fact that morphine was very difficult to detect, and he was proved to be right. Although the doctors agreed that Auguste Ballet had shown all the signs of morphine poisoning, vomiting, diarrhoea, heavy breathing, contraction of the pupils, no trace of morphine could be detected in his stomach. The prosecutor asked indignantly if all murderers who used morphine should be allowed to go free just because medical science was unable to detect its presence. That swung the jury. Castaing was sentenced to death and executed in December 1823, protesting his innocence. The next medical murder of any note took place in the peaceful environment of Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, more than a quarter of a century later. Like so many medical murderers, Professor John Webster, aged 56, was given to living beyond his means. He frequently borrowed money from a wealthy friend, Dr. George Parkman. But Parkman ceased to be friendly when he learned that Webster's famous mineral collection, which Webster had pledged to him as security for a loan, had also been pledged to another creditor. The angry Parkman threatened exposure. On November the 23rd, 1849, Parkman failed to return home for lunch, and the river was dredged in case he had drowned. In fact, Parkman had called on Webster in his laboratory, and as he turned to go out, Webster had struck him such a tremendous blow on the back of the head with a piece of wood that he died. Later on, Webster alleged that Parkman had been so insulting that he had hit him in blind rage, but all the evidence indicates a cool head and careful planning. Later the same day, he told an agent who collected his lecture fees that he had repaid Parkman. And that night, behind locked doors, he proceeded to dismember the body and to burn it in his medical furnace. 2 days after Parkman's disappearance, Webster called on his family and told them that he had repaid Parkman a few hours before his disappearance. Surely this proved that Parkman had been killed by a robber who had concealed the body. Unfortunately for Webster, the caretaker at the medical school, Littlefield, detested him. Littlefield wondered why the doctor worked all night in his laboratory and kept his furnace burning all the time. Whenever Webster left the laboratory, he took care to double-lock the door. But Littlefield had a plan. The furnace was built against a wall, and there was a passageway on the other side. With his wife standing guard, Littlefield broke through the wall with a crowbar and shone his torch through, and he saw a bone which he recognised as a human pelvis. At his trial, which lasted 11 days and got national press coverage, Webster pleaded not guilty. He contended that the bones in the furnace were not Parkman's at all, just the remains of a body they had been using for dissection. But a dentist positively identified the false teeth as Parkman's, and Webster's defence collapsed. Before he was hanged in August of 1850, he confessed to killing Parkman in a fit of rage. The murder of Parkman was the beginning of what might be called the Great Age of Medical Murderers. It lasted for about 100 years, from approximately 1855, the year in which Dr. William Palmer of Rugeley poisoned his racetrack associate John Cook, to 1954, when Dr. Sam Shepherd of Ohio was found guilty of murdering his wife. Studying the killers, an interesting point emerges. A great majority of the medical murderers were weak characters, given to lying or boasting and to living beyond their means. And this implies that many of them were drawn to the medical profession to satisfy vanity, the self-esteem urge. This was perhaps most obvious in the case of the Glasgow poisoner Dr. Edward William Pritchard. In photographs, he looks a typical Victorian paterfamilias, with his frock coat and bushy beard, surrounded by a respectable-looking family. In fact, he was an utterly weak character, a joke amongst his colleagues because of his incredible boasting and lying. He claimed to be a friend of the Italian patriot Giuseppe Garibaldi, although they'd certainly never met. A typical narcissist, he was fond of presenting people with photographs of himself. He even handed one to a stranger he met on a train. He gave lectures, mostly invented, in which he described himself as an intrepid traveller and hunter. He also regarded himself as a great lover and seduced servant girls and anyone else who would have him. In 1863, when he was 38, a fire broke out in the room of the servant girl in his house, She was found dead, and it seemed clear that she had made no attempt to leave her bed during the fire. Pritchard was widely suspected, but he nevertheless won a claim from an insurance company. In 1864, he made another servant girl, aged 15, pregnant, but performed an abortion. And it may have been desire to marry her that led him to start poisoning his wife, Mary, to whom he had been married for nearly 20 years. In November 1864, she became ill, vomiting and dizzy. A doctor called in by Pritchard suspected she was being poisoned and wrote to Mary Pritchard's brother, suggesting that she should be moved into hospital. The result was that Mary Pritchard's mother, Mrs. Taylor, decided to come and to nurse her daughter. Soon, Mrs. Taylor was suffering from the same symptoms. She died on February the 24th, 1865, and Mrs. Pritchard followed a month later. Pritchard provided both death certificates, stating that Mrs. Taylor died of apoplexy and his wife of gastric fever. Someone wrote an anonymous letter to the police, and Pritchard was arrested. When the bodies were exhumed, both were found to be saturated with antimony, which Pritchard was proved to have bought. Since the 1880s, England has produced her fair quota of medical murderers, while America has produced many more. There was Dr. Milton Bowers of San Francisco, who almost certainly poisoned three of his wives, but who succeeded in persuading a jury to acquit him in 1888 and lived happily, with another wife, until 1905. Most ambitious of all was Dr. Clark Hyde of Kansas City, who decided in 1909 to poison no less than seven relatives who stood between him and the fortune of Thomas Swope, the millionaire founder of Kansas City. Hyde was married to Swope's niece, Frances. In October of that year, Swope and his financial adviser, James Hunton, died, apparently from natural causes. Shortly afterwards, Hyde procured several test tubes of diphtheria and typhoid germs, claiming he intended to take up the study of bacteriology. Five assorted brothers and sisters-in-law fell ill, and Hyde told them it was typhoid fever. Chrisman Swope died after Hyde administered a capsule and other members of the family showed symptoms of typhoid fever. When Hyde left on a trip to New York, all the patients improved considerably, which confirmed the suspicion of the nurses that the doctor was responsible for their illness. Hyde then made a curious mistake. Walking along a lamplit street, he took something out of his pocket and stamped it into the snow. One of the brothers-in-law saw him and investigated. He picked up a broken capsule and recognised the odour as potassium cyanide. The body of old Thomas Swope was exhumed, and cyanide and strychnine were found in it. Hyde was tried and found guilty, but he had money enough to appeal to a whole series of higher courts, and in 1917 he was freed. Since the trial of Sam Shepard in 1954, there have been no more medical murders in the United States, or, if there have been, they've gone undiscovered. Nowadays, when there's almost no poison or drug that can't be detected, even in the smallest quantities, it looks as though the great epoch of the medical murderer, who mostly killed out of greed and for gain, is over.